Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Coach Chat Radio. I'm Laurie Lawson, and the fantastic co-host is the always amazing.
And you always have me blushing. It's Bernie Siegel here in New York City today.
It's a good way to start a show, blushing, I think, yes. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Coach Chat. We believe if you change your perspective, you can change your life. And for coaches and those interested in one of the fastest-growing professions in the world today, Coach Chat hooks you up with some of the world's leading coaches who share expertise and give you tips and takeaways for expanding and improving your life and your business. And today we have longtime friend, we've had her on a couple of times and we're just fascinated with it, Dani Tichtin-Koplik. Hey, Dani.
Hello, hello, Bernie. Hello, Laurie. Nice to see you, hear you today.
Yes, we can't see each other, but luckily we have two little snafus, but now we can all hear each other, so life is working good. Let me tell you a little bit about Dani, and then we're going to get into our conversation today. Dani founded DTK Resources, and that's kind of like an executive coaching and consulting boutique, I love that, in New York City, that offers leadership development training, career development coaching, executive coaching, training, business consulting, and we consider her our DEI expert, diversity, equity, and inclusion expert. So we are going to talk to her about today about one of her pet peeves, all of our pet peeves, I think. So, Dani, welcome to Coach Chat. Thank you for being on again. We always find whatever you've got to say pretty interesting. So thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. I always love an opportunity to be able to, like, you know, get on my soapbox. So thank you.
Well, here we are. Bernie, what's your first question for Dani?
Okay. I know you've mentioned this in the past, but these are probably new listeners. Our audience loves to know a little bit about your journey and how you got to where you are today. So if you could just let us know briefly a little bit about that.
Sure. It's you know, certainly a scenic route, which is true for many, many women. I started out in the entertainment industry, which was a lot of fun but horribly managed and horribly run, and a vanity industry is never a great one to work in unless you're at the very top because, you know, you're at the whim of just nonsense. So I did that until I had a small child. I had a brief lapse of sanity and worked for the phone company for a while, and that was an error in my thinking. But I ended up retiring for a while and being a full-time soccer mom. And, you know, the truth is, yes, I wanted to do that. That's what I always wanted to do, and I wanted to be there for my children, and we'd moved to the suburbs, and my husband traveled a lot. But the truth is that I bailed on my career mid-career, and the reason why I bailed was because I had no skills. I didn't know how to manage up, down, sideways. I didn't know how to give or take feedback. I didn't know what my voice was and how to express it. So there were many, many things that I didn't know. So when I decided, after a couple of people suggested it, I went and got trained and certified as an executive coach. I decided that I needed to start with the things I most needed to learn, which was all of these skills that I didn't have that I am now equipped to teach to other women. So I worked with a lot of women, developed a lot of programs for women. And as time went on, that, you know, the need for parity kind of expanded to where we are now in diversity, equity, inclusion, which is basically all historically excluded people. It's not just people of color. It's not just women. It's all historically excluded people. So that's kind of where I am now, and I do a lot of writing and thinking and talking about a lot of these interconnected issues. We find ourselves right now at the cusp of something called human-centered leadership, and it's a very fragile place to be because we got here through 3 years of COVID and racial trauma, and now that things are recovering or back to office and all that business, I just worry that we're going to revert to the mean, and it's not going to mean that much anymore. So those of us at the front line, we need to keep working toward this human-centered leadership and management.
Thanks. I love that title, human-centered management.
And what does that actually mean to you? I know we've had emotional, emotional information. We've had all kinds of things that are like touchy feeling. You know, you got to get into the person. You can't be just the NBA, you know, rules and regulations. What does that mean to you?
Well, you hit me at a good time because I just taught a class to an exec ed group. To me, it means that whenever we come out of trauma, whether it's 9/11 or the Great Recession, people get kinder and gentler because they realize that people's psyches are not safe and people are very vulnerable. The difference now is that the qualities that we used to think of as weaknesses, like vulnerability, compassion, empathy in the workplace, are now positive attributes. I hope it holds on, but, you know, one of the big things is for companies to provide psychological safety, not just physical safety, but as we sort of lumbered through COVID and lockdown and all kinds of stress, it was really clear that people needed to be taken care of, workers need to be taken care of in a very different way. So providing the psychological safety, it's safe to come to work, but it's also safe to speak your mind. It's safe to, you need some autonomy when you have no control. There are a number of different factors that came into play, but the leaders who did well during this traumatic time when it was still work from home pretty much and then hybrid are the ones who allowed themselves to show their own vulnerability, their own fragility, their own issues. It became much more personal. They became personally interested in their employees. Employees were no longer, you know, toy soldiers or chess pieces. They were human beings with very real, difficult problems and 2 tons of loss. So, you know, very few people have come through this unscathed, whether they've had disease themselves, whether they were excluded themselves, whatever it might be. They're just, we've been very wounded, and so it's been very, very important for leaders to adopt a new model. And so that's kind of where we are. The good news is for women is that a lot of these things come naturally, and it's been a big adjustment for sort of the more senior men in charge to go against what they were always taught. You can't show emotion in the workplace. You know, you can't show vulnerability. You have to be all powerful. That's really not what's needed right now. So that's how we get to this.
So it's fascinating because the issues that I'm dealing with right now in terms of what you're talking about, I've got people saying, well, what are you talking about? I'm not a therapist. I'm not comfortable with this. How do you work with people who have that type, and have you run across people that kind of feel that way, that I don't want to get into this stuff? How do you work with them as a coach to get
right.
them more comfortable?
Well, you know, we know in coaching that there's some big black lines, and there's a big black line between coaching and psychotherapy. We may have high psychological EQ, emotional intelligence, psychological intelligence, but we do have that big black line, and we're all about helping people find their own solutions. But what gets in the way are, and I don't know if you're familiar with this acronym, but the SCARF threats. The brain is organized in one very particular way to help us survive, and that's threat and reward. And because, you know, back in the day, we were worried about the saber-toothed tiger, and, you know, you slay it or you get eaten. There were real physical threats. When we have threat to our own psyches, that's processed in the same place as that other threat. We scan for it because it's a matter of survival. We have to know what the threat is. And that's when cortisol gets released and people don't make good decisions and people become very prickly or they shut down or they lose their motivation. On the flip side is this thing called reward, which is harder for us to look for, but is so easy to give, and it only takes a tiny bit to get people to a reward state. Just saying something like good job make somebody feel appreciated. So the point is to know what the triggers are for people, even our own clients, and work through those particular triggers and say, all right, you didn't like the way that happened in that meeting. What kind of a threat was that? Was that a SCARF stands for status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness? Was that a fairness threat? Did you feel like you weren't being treated fairly? Or was it a status threat? Was someone undermining your authority, your position? Or was that, I said fairness, certainty. Wait, you're looking for complete certainty from your boss, but you can't get certainty anymore, but you can get clarity. So it's understanding what's going on in the brain really, really helps, not counsel, but explain to people why they are where they are, and then come up with hacks to get past it. So, as I said, with certainty, a big one is for bosses was you can't provide your employees certainty during the age of COVID, but you can clarify what you're doing about it, and that relieves a lot of that threat.
Great. Yeah, it's a little bit of a science in it, and I think that clients
a lot of
appreciate
science.
That.
It is. It's all neuroscience.
It.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy to say it's a longer conversation, but go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. It's a great conversation. Go ahead. I mean it this time. Really, go ahead.
No, I mean, I'm just sort of skimming the surface, but it's enough to give you the idea that we don't have to fix, psychiatry, go into our past, what birth order, where are you in the birth order, what did your parents do to you, what did your grandparents do to them? We don't need that. As coaches, we start from present and move forward. So that's why it's interesting to know where are we in terms of those SCARF threats today, and how do we mitigate them so that we are able to move forward, make progress.
Yeah, definitely. And that kind of segues right into what I was when we have like and this is just totally opinion, we have no, well, we may have science behind it, but it's like because it seems like we keep coming up with new terminology, like we had positive psychology and we've got emotional intelligence and now we've got human-centered leadership. And what do you think is going on today where people are just going, nope, that's not good enough, or nope, I'm not going to take it anymore? What do you think is happening, because we seem to be trying harder, and I'm going to say succeeding less
it's
format, right?
Right. It's sort of like the winter of our discontent. Everybody's unhappy. I think that anytime you have some sort of a contraction, whether it's economic contraction or social contraction with triggers and things like that, people get afraid. They get very, very afraid, and it's hard for them to stay invested. So you've got this lots of new terminology, which I hope ends up, as I say, in the trash bin of all this outdated, and you use it so much, like purpose, it gets on my nerves. It's like, purpose is at the top of Maslow's hierarchy, so let's forget that in the everyday. It doesn't really work for me. So, yes, there are a lot of these, and I think a reason is because the good news is we have a lot of diversity in the workplace. But what that means is there's no cookie-cutter mold for people anymore. HR is way burdened, and I don't know that they even have the training or the skills to deal with the multiplicity of issues. Not only do we have a more diverse population in terms of race, gender, neurodiversity, ableism, all of that. But we now have another generation in the workforce. And I did listen to one of your shows, Lori, and someone put everything at the feet of millennials. And I just need to do a teeny tweak there. Millennials already have mortgages and children and houses and car loans and stuff like that. They're not the ones agitating. It's the next generation, Gen Z, that are the ones who want things done differently. They're the ones who were in college during COVID and are saying, no mas, I've worked from home, I need the relatedness, but I have a different sense of freedom than I had before, and I don't want to do anything that isn't what I want to do. So, you know, companies and bosses have to accommodate a lot of this. I'm not saying coddle. I made this distinction yesterday to a group. I never think that we should coddle new generations because everybody gets a trophy and all that. But we do need to know where they're coming from, and we do need to be able to speak their language because, after all, once we older folk, you know, and leadership generations move on to wherever, the great wherever, you know, once we move on, they're going to be in charge. So, you know, it's really incumbent on all of us to understand what they're saying, address the realities of it, but still hold the mission and vision and the goals of an organization. I don't know many, other than not-for-profits, I don't know many that open their doors to make less money. So it's, you know, it's something that workers need to be cognizant of. And they're it's fueled, too, by the job market where, as you said, nobody has enough people and nobody has the right people. So there's a little bit of empowerment there that goes on with the youngest people especially where it's like, I don't like this. Hell no, I'm not staying. Or you don't have enough diversity here. I don't see any inclusion here. I don't see my company doing, you know, public services and getting involved in social issues. I'm out of here. And they have that freedom right now. They do.
You're talking about so many important issues, and so I'm trying to process and absorb it, because yes, leaders are still responsible for the goals and the mission of the organization. There's a philosophy now called servant leadership. I don't know if you work with servant leadership, but it's really all about what you just said. Yeah, you're responsible for those things as a leader, but now you need to really support your people and find out what they need to be developed. And that's where I think a lot of leaders are stuck, because one of the things you need to do is feedback, and you need to ask for feedback from your people, which most leaders have never done, and obviously you need to give feedback, which most people hate to do because you don't know what's going to happen. Well, if you could just talk a little bit about that, I think it would be helpful.
Sure. Yeah, this is. I actually wrote an article that appeared in Authority magazine about feedback, and it was basically how leaders can do it without causing harm. But what's happening now is a little bit of an upside down, where for leaders to know how to be more humane, right, and human centered, they need to know exactly what their people are thinking. So you've seen an increase in the number of town halls, focus groups, open conversations, you know, happy hour things to try to elicit what's going on and what needs to be addressed. So that feedback, I've always thought, and I'll go back a second, I used to work for a professional service firm. I was retained by a professional service firm. And, you know, they would get their annual reviews and stuff, or they got this ridiculous questionnaire, which was still trying to give ratings and rankings and percentages. And when you have four people answering a question, how do you have any result that's statistically relevant? Is my first question. But I always thought that, you know, in addition to the people below getting ranked and rated and assessed and verbatims and, you know, qualitative feedback, that leadership, not the individuals, but the leadership of the company, of the firm, ought to have a question in there, too. What can we do to do this better? And that is not something that is typically done. I think they're doing it now with polls and surveys and like that. But, again, this is a fragile state, this human-centered leadership. And I just worry that as more things sort of go back to the mean, this is going to get lost. So I think it's incumbent on those evolved leaders and forward-thinking leaders to keep this going. But I agree, Bernie, that now there does have to be upward feedback. I mean, feedback in general is done poorly, whether it's done up, down, or sideways. And, there, you know, if you use those scarf factors, you know what you're talking about, so you know what's a threat, you can sort of position something in a way that won't be threatening but constructive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know you developed something called dynamic inquiry.
I did.
And I have. Yes, you did, and we want to hear about that for sure. And now while you're at it, you can tell us, how do you feel about annual reviews?
Oh, thank you for asking. I'm not sure you want to hear it, but I mostly don't care for them, and for a number of reasons. There is so much angst around that, filling those things out that are voluminous, and if you have 20 direct reports, you know, you're really in the soup. It's too overwhelming, and then to have to deliver it, and then to have to receive it. When it's done on an annual basis, there are a number of problems. One is, and a very important one, if there are examples that have to be presented as a habit or a behavior or a skill that needs to be changed, why wait a year? You know, you've lost a year on it. The examples are not relevant anymore. And, oh, by the way, you've perpetuated these behaviors for a year rather than nipping them in the bud on a more frequent basis. So if you – dynamic inquiry means that it's something always in motion. It's not a static thing. So the more often there can be a regular feedback loop, the smaller the course correction, the less threatening the input, and the more quickly you resolve the problem. So you get better performance at an earlier stage, and you don't get resentment. You know what it's like. I'm sure you've coached people off the ledge who have gotten terrible performance reviews. It doesn't need to be that way. It should never get to that place.
You're reminding me of when I began my first job out of college at KPMG. I worked for a year, and I had a bad experience with one person on doing one thing, and that was my review, and it affected me tremendously.
Yeah.
And it's just horrible. So I'm sorry you just reminded me of that, because that was a long time ago, and I guess I never forgot it. Michelle Barnes, that was her name.
All right, we'll remember her. Forget it.
Hope she's not listening. So this is also fascinating, this stuff. We've touched in the past on emotional intelligence. How do you – some people call social skills. To me, they're not social skills or soft skills. They're really important skills.
They are. I'm with you. I call them essential skills, critical skills.
Yeah. It's 90% of – I always say to leaders, 90% of what you do is probably going to be dealing with your people, whether they're your peers or your direct reports or the people above you. Probably 90%. If you don't want to do that, you shouldn't be doing that job. How do you work with people in improving their emotional intelligence? So maybe first thing, where they are in terms of their EQ.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes will work with people on an issue in a different area. So, you know, I would say you need to have three goals. I'm less strict than I used to be, but three goals from three different areas of your life. And what I have found is that if you can personalize the situation, I'll give you a quick example. Years ago, I coached someone who worked for Johnson & Johnson, and he was a great salesman, but he never got promoted because people couldn't stand him. He didn't suffer fools gladly. I talk about no EQ. You know, he was a salesman, and he was hard-driving, and he didn't like all the blah-blah and people bothering him and this and that. Anyway, he came to me, and, you know, he reluctant and resistant, aside from anything else, I was a woman. But in one of our early conversations, it was about, okay, tell me about some other part of your life. And it was about his teenage daughter and how they're always yelling at each other, how they're at it. They have no relationship. I said, here's your homework. This weekend, you know, talk to him on a Friday, over the weekend, find one small thing to compliment her on. One small thing. It can be the color of her nail polish. I really don't care. Anything. And don't you know that relationship turned around in a weekend, and then he started to see the validity of giving that tiny little bit of a dopamine drop to people. You know, we crave that. We love that. And it makes us just more, you know, you start seeing things through other people's eyes. You take a little walk in their shoes. I'm not sure true empathy can exactly happen, because, you know, if you're a white person trying to have empathy, you know, with a black person's life, you're never going to walk in those shoes. You're never going to walk in those shoes. You can try to approximate understanding, but you can never, you know, it's sort of a canard that you can actually feel empathy for everybody. I think compassion is a much better word. But, you know, when you start to see results with very tiny, tiny acts, that's what motivates people to do more of it. Because, by the way, when you give someone else a dopamine drop, you feel great yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that helped, if that was
yes.
Like on track with your, okay, good.
Yes, yes.
Good. You know, it's important. You have to personalize it a little bit. And maybe, you know, with active listening and mirroring and everything, when they are a little bit reluctant, you say, but you know what? I just heard you say this about this. What's the difference between there and here?
Active listening, to show you're listening, because how many people today in general listen to anybody? Mostly on their phones, waiting for their next text.
Right, that's right, or waiting to say the thing they have in their mind. So that was one of the things with this guy from J&J, is that he was terrible in meetings, and I said to him, just stop yourself. I go very low tech. Put a rubber band around your wrist. Every time you want to like roll your eyes, snap it. Come back to the present. Keep coming back to the present. Be there. And don't you know, he got promoted. People went up to his boss, his manager, and this is only after about 3 months. What happened to Kevin? He's a different person. What happened to him? So when that act of compassion or when you are able to show some emotional intelligence towards someone else, they feel great and you feel great. So I guess the idea with a client is to get them to the place where they understand how good it feels to make someone else feel good.
That's great. Thanks.
Sure. Sure. You know, you stick around long enough, you observe long enough, you start to see this stuff. Right? But it definitely, you know, I think that EQ has a sort of broader definition. Now we're really honing it down to the compassion, the empathy, the psychological safety, physical well-being, mental well-being. These are all on the table now. I just think it's up to all of us and to any listeners and to frontline leaders to keep this going, because it's so easy for us to go back to our old ways.
And I love the concept, of, you know, we are individualizing and dealing with it on a timely basis and giving feedback. But let me ask you something about assessments. Time you turn around, there's a new assessment. I have a pet peeve, and it might be assessments.
Me too.
How do you see? How good? Yeah, because I just don't get it. Unless you're going to wear your letters or your numbers or your symbols, whatever you are on your forehead, I am not taking the time to memorize that. So me dealing with you on that level is probably not going to happen. How do you feel about assessments?
Yeah, I don't care for them for just the reason that you said, which is that I find them limiting. You know, if we're in the business of trying to help people, and I say not reach their potential but push through their perceived potential, why would I characterize myself as an ABCD and live to that moniker? I don't think that it really has that much value, and you know, I'm a shade of gray person. I think many coaches have to live in that gray space, and I feel like assessments are too black and white. In addition to which, there was one time I was working with a guy who was supposed to improve his emotional intelligence, and his company thought they were being all that, and they paid $75,000 for him to take a personality test, and I could have told, first of all, the results, I could have told them exactly what was going to come out of it. But don't you know, this guy was so smart and crafty, he gamed it. He went and researched the person who founded this thing, what their point was, what they're trying to elicit. Yeah. He totally gamed it. So what's the point?
Wow.
Right? What is the point? And, you know, I don't even like the implicit bias assessment from Harvard. I just think that anybody who designs these things is imposing their biases on it in the first place.
Oh, my. Do you believe we're almost out of time? That's why we keep asking
you
that, because we find what you're saying fascinating. How can people find you, Miss Danny? Please let us know.
Hi. Well, thank you. Yeah, so I'm at dtkresources.com. Email is dtk@dtkresources.com. And please, where I do a lot of my conversing and a lot of my thinking is on LinkedIn. So you can find me there under Dani Ticton Koplik. And, yeah, not Facebook, but LinkedIn I find to be an interesting forum for conversation. And as a colleague said to me once, you poke the bear. It's like I can't let it be still. I've got to like, improve what people say, what they think. So, yeah, that's where it is.
Well, we love your bear poking, and we're certainly going to ask you to come on back. Okay,
oh, I
guys.
It. I love it.
we gotta end this episode, unfortunately. Bernie, thank you so much for always being the greatest co-host in the world. And Dani, thank you for always being one of our
favorite guests.
So,
well,
we
I love it. Anytime.
Okay. We're holding
thanks
you to
lot.
It.
And thank you both so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
You are welcome. Bye-bye.